Hello, and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. During the month of February, the Global Campus is offering the online course, Negotiation, Shaping the Conflict Landscape. And this week in the course, we've been looking at ways to optimize one's negotiations, how to gain leverage when there is an asymmetry of power, how to be persuasive without being threatening, how to distinguish between someone's positions and interests, and how to prepare for a negotiation. To help us explore these questions in greater depth, we are joined in the studio today by our guest, Andrea Harrison. Andrea serves as Deputy Legal Advisor for the Washington Delegation of the International Committee of the Red Cross. In this capacity, she is responsible for legal support to ICRC activities in the United States and Canada, with a particular focus on detention issues, military commissions, privileges and immunities, and weapons issues. Prior to her recent posting in Washington, Andrea served in ICRC's headquarters in Geneva as legal advisor to operations for the Near and Middle East and Central and Southern Africa. Before this, she was a legal attaché to the ICRC's legal division in Geneva. In addition, Andrea teaches law of war as an adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service. I am an alum, so props to that. She also serves as the chair of the International Humanitarian Law Committee of the American branch of the International Law Association. Andrea, thank you for being with us today on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
We are also joined in the studio by our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis. She will be moderating your questions and comments throughout the show. So, Vanessa, will you say hello to our listeners?
Hello, listeners. Very much looking forward to your questions and comments today.
We look to you and to our many listeners from around the world to help guide this conversation and engage with our guest. So, when you have a question or a comment, all you need to do is notify Vanessa by clicking that little raise hand button that's on your control panel, and Vanessa will get you queued up. She will let you know when you are about to go on air, and then she'll unmute you and bring you into the show so you can share your question or comment directly. Now, if you do not have a microphone on your computer, you can also instant message Vanessa by typing your question or comment into the chat box on your control panel, and then Vanessa will read it for you on air. And to those listeners out there who are participants in this online course, you'll remember our show last week with Anthony Juanese St. John. He works with Andrea at American University and is unable to be with us today. He's doing another negotiation training, but will be joining us next week as my co-host. So with that, let's start the conversation. Andrea, before we get into the specifics of your work, we like to start the show a little bit on the lighter side and give our listeners a sense of who you are beyond your professional title and description. And so we do an exercise called 3-2-1, and it involves a series of questions that give us a bigger window into who you are and what makes you tick. So the first question is, what are three things people might be surprised to learn about you?
So the first is usually that I'm from Texas. I don't have an accent, so people are usually a little surprised by that. Second is that I really did not like law school, and I did not plan on being a lawyer about halfway through law school, but obviously things changed. The third, I used to have pet snakes, so I'm a big fan of snakes.
Wow. From Texas and has pet snakes. All right. I feel like maybe that does make sense. I don't know. Where in Texas did you grow up?
In Dallas.
In Dallas? Okay, nice. Second question, what are two things outside of your profession that you enjoy doing?
I love traveling to anywhere new that I can have time to go see, and yoga.
Any particular kind of yoga? Are you like that deep into it that there's a particular kind that you
No,
like?
I mean vinyasa, but flow, that type, but no, not really.
Okay, great. And last question, who is one person, past or present, dead or alive, who you would like to have dinner with?
I think that'd be Jose Mujica, the current president of Uruguay. I'm fascinated by that man. He's such an interesting character.
For those of us who are unfamiliar with him, could you tell us a little bit about what you find fascinating about him?
Just generally, he's been very liberal and progressive, and Uruguay was actually considered to be like the happiest country, I think, voted by The Economist, the most successful country, whatever, last year. I mean, he's really brought a lot of change to the country. From my personal perspective, it's also because he was so willing to take the 6 Guantanamo detainees just
That's
based on
right.
humanitarian sort of feelings, as he explained it, and I think that was a great sign for the rest of the world, who will hopefully follow his example.
Nice, nice. Now you work for the International Committee of the Red Cross and the ICRC. It has a presence in conflict zones all over the world. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think there are some conflict zones where the Red Cross is the only international organization that has been granted access or even dares
Yes,
to operate.
in a few contexts.
What are those contexts where or Red Cross is like the only international organization there?
For ones that I am probably allowed to name, Syria, most areas in Syria, that will be the International Committee of the Red Cross, along with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, has the permission to work in areas like Damascus and around there. Also in parts of northern Nigeria, I believe we're currently the only, but certainly one of the only organizations that's been able to get access in those areas.
And what does the ICRC do that makes its presence and its mission so vital in conflict zones?
I mean, I think there's a number of things. For one, I mean, obviously the assistance we're bringing sort of opens doors, and the fact that we can have this confidential dialogue with parties to the conflict, and we do reach out to every party, regardless of whether they're a state or non-state armed group. And so I think that sort of neutral approach has sort of gained us a reputation for just being there just to do humanitarian assistance and not having some sort of political goal or taking sides one way or the other. And it's been 150 years of sort of proving that too. There's other organizations who have the same mandate, but we have the added benefit of a long history and also a long history in some of the worst conflicts in the world, in Afghanistan and Colombia. We've been there for 3, 4 decades now, Israel as well. I think almost 4 decades now in Israel. So I think that makes a difference as well, sort of having established that reputation.
Now, when you say humanitarian assistance, what are some examples of that?
So this will vary from place to place. I mean, one of our core mandates is what we would call protection activities, so protection of the civilian population. This can range in having a dialogue with the parties to the conflict on how they engage in warfare, so what types of weapons they're using, whether they're targeting civilians, sort of this aspect of protecting them from the effects of warfare. The other is detention visits, so going to visit anyone detained in relation to a conflict. So of course the traditional thing there would be POWs, that's what everyone thinks about, but to be honest, nowadays POWs is not our main audience. It's more in non-international conflicts, so you're just talking about people sort of detained by their own governments often, but again in relation to that, and bringing services to those prisons in a lot of cases, whether it be just recommendations on how to improve the water system or the hygiene. It can be anything, and it really will depend on who the authority is. So with a state party with a lot of resources like the US, obviously our dialogue would be very different than somewhere in a very poor country, maybe in Africa, where it's very basic what we're having to work on. And then in some places, especially where we do have access and other organizations don't, then you're going to see even more emphasis on sort of traditional humanitarian assistance in the sense of bringing food and direct medical services, because the infrastructure has dissolved or because no one else can get in, and we might be doing a lot more hands-on in those places, just because we're there.
Now, in terms of being granted access into some of these conflict zones, and you mentioned Syria earlier and some other countries, northern Nigeria, does the International Committee on the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, is it granted this access because it's one of the only international organizations that has the capacity to operate in those types of zones? And or is it because the trust over its 150-year history has been built that governments or parties to the conflict have faith or have trust that you'll do good work or unbiased work. What makes ICRC so special aside from other organizations that also provide humanitarian assistance?
In certain contexts, so we actually have what we call a conventional mandate. So in the Geneva Conventions, the International Committee of the Red Cross is actually specified as being the organization that can go visit POWs, that can provide certain humanitarian assistance. So there you can kind of see. Also, we have our statutes, which all state parties to the Geneva Conventions, and the Geneva Conventions are universally ratified, and have signed on to our statutes, have approved them essentially. And there it also kind of lists what the ICRC can do in armed conflict and in other situations of violence. So in one sense, we have this sort of state mandate, and that's often one way we sort of can get access, at least when it's a state party that we're trying to get access. In other cases, either of states that don't necessarily agree with whether or not we have a right to access at that moment or not, or with non-state actors who've never signed a treaty there. I mean, I think we are relying much more on sort of our reputation. And again, sort of we have to sometimes build with little baby steps that sort of knowledge of who we are. Because, okay, in some places like Afghanistan, they've known us for many decades in an area that's maybe never experienced conflict or at least never experienced an ICRC intervention in a conflict. We're starting from scratch. So it's really knocking on the door of the tribal leaders and saying, okay, this is who we are. We're neutral, impartial, independent. This is what we want to do. These are the services we want to provide. And you might have to go have 100 cups of tea with that tribal leader before he's like, well, let me go introduce you to this commander over here. Maybe you two should talk. I mean, that's a very basic way of putting it, but I think that's sort of how it's structured, and we don't go in until we have that acceptance.
Now, you serve as the deputy legal advisor to the Washington delegation of the ICRC. And actually, you mentioned in your introduction that you didn't even think that you wanted to be a lawyer, but now you find yourself working for ICRC in this capacity. So as a lawyer, what drew you to the ICRC as a place where you wanted to work?
So I actually arrived in Geneva, and Geneva's where the ICRC is headquartered, for those listeners who don't know that. So I arrived in Geneva to go to school, and I planned on doing refugee or human rights law. I wasn't really sure which, but that city has everything, so I figured it would be a good place to start. And I took one class on international humanitarian law, IHL, and I was just hooked. I really was fascinated by the subject, and the practitioner had been an ICRC delegate for many years, and so he had a lot of war stories. And I started studying for a competition that's called the Pictet, the Jean Pictet competition, where you're sort of role-playing an ICRC delegate, essentially, in the competition. Unlike sort of Jessup and these other moot courts, it's much more sort of interactive with the judges. And after doing that, applied to the ICRC internships, because I just, even that sort of role-playing an ICRC lawyer, an ICRC delegate, to me was, I realized that I enjoyed that work and that type of interaction with the law. And so I joined right after school, the ICRC's legal division.
Nice. Well, from role play to real life, you now, again, are the deputy legal advisor. And your main responsibilities are to provide legal support to activities in the United States and Canada, as was mentioned in your introduction. And there's a particular focus on detention issues, military commissions, privileges and immunities, and weapons issues. So I'd love for you to share some examples of the kind of legal work and some of the negotiation work that's done around these areas. So can you give us an example of a detention issue on which you've provided legal support?
Sure. So maybe just to give sort of a general answer first, the legal work I normally do is sort of bifurcated into the legal support I provide to the ICRC. So often that will be, if something's going on, the U.S. is engaged in some sort of military operation and something happens and we need to provide some feedback to Geneva on what's going on the ground, I might provide sort of the U.S. legal framework. So this is the authorization for the use of military force that the U.S. was operating under. This is what they've justified it on. These were the rules of engagement they were using, or maybe not rules of engagement, those are usually classified, but something sort of sex, and explaining to my headquarters sort of the U.S. take on this from a legal perspective. And then we also then go to the U.S. government directly once we're sort of engaged on an issue to sort of give the ICRC's position on what the international law is. So if let's say, and I'm sorry to always pick on the U.S., that's who I work with, let's say the U.S. has engaged in a drone strike and some civilians were killed, we might approach them and be like, okay, we don't know what happened. This could be an accident, whatever, but here are the legal obligations.
You would approach who?
Well, depending on maybe in that case, someone doing the operations in Afghanistan, so okay. the command level in Afghanistan, but then also the Pentagon, sort of the, whether it's CENTCOM or SOUTHCOM as well. There's sort of a lot of different levels in the U.S. military that you could be having this discussion with. So you would sort of approach whoever that you need to, that you know that you're going to have this discussion with, and be like, okay, this is, if we'll just remind you of the law, this is what the Geneva Conventions or the additional protocols say, this is our interpretation of that. And it's sort of, it's not an accusation, it's always a confidential bilateral discussion we would have, but then again, it's a sharing. So I'm sort of the liaison between the U.S. law to Geneva and ICRC, not law, but interpretations of the law to the U.S. government.
Okay. Looks like we have a question or comment from one of our listeners.
We do. Andrea, one of our listeners wrote out, you mentioned that Syria is one conflict area where ICRC has access and the ability to talk with combating parties. Does this include talking with ISIS, ISIL? If yes, are there any criteria which the ICRC employs that would make a combatant group off limits? Would a group be considered so heinous that the ICRC would not deal with it?
So ISIS is a very interesting case because they're not just in Syria. So there we're talking about Iraq as well. We don't have at the moment, unless something's changed in the last week or two, we don't have direct dialogue with ISIS. But we are providing services to certain areas where ISIS is in control through intermediaries. A lot of people who remained in the areas where ISIS sort of took over, and this is, I would say, more particularly in Iraq right now, not Syria. We've had contacts with those people who are still running the government departments or the hospitals that they were running before. And so we knew them because we've been in Iraq for quite a long time, since the Iraq war, actually. So we had contacts already, and we've been able to send like medical supplies and things like that through these persons. But we are still not able to bring ICRC personnel into ISIS-controlled areas as of my last update. And I apologize if that's out of date. As far as the other sort of aspect of that question on whether we would not talk to anyone, no. I mean, that is sort of the whole basis on which the ICRC operates, is that we will talk absolutely to everyone, and I would say even more so to groups that are maybe responsible for more heinous crimes, because they're going to be the ones who would need to have that sort of interaction and intervention and discussion on not just the law, but on the sort of humanitarian consequences of their acts. A perfectly law-abiding country or group doesn't need the ICRC as much as one who is violating really basic humanitarian standards. And so with ISIS, with Al-Qaeda, with whatever group that's out there, that's going to be someone that we actually want to talk to the most, probably, because that's who we would hope to be able to bring some change to, other way of thinking, or whatever it is.
So help us lay the context for the kind of legal work that you're doing. So you mentioned earlier that you were in Geneva, you're in law school, and you take this International Humanitarian Law course, or IHL. So talk to me like I'm a 10-year-old, and what is international humanitarian law, kind of in a nutshell, for the 10-year-old in me?
Okay. So before I talk to you like a 10-year-old, maybe also just to say that in the U.S., it's usually referred to, IHL is usually referred to as law of armed conflict or law of war. So sometimes that triggers things in people's head. We're like, oh, okay, now I know what you're talking about. But they're all the same. Law of war, law of armed conflict, international humanitarian law are the same body of law governing the conduct of the parties to an armed conflict. So it's the rules, it's the prohibitions that occur when an armed conflict exists. So armed conflict being, you know, the colloquial term war, but there really is a legal definition of what an armed conflict is. And so this will be a series of different types of rules. So the basis is the Geneva Conventions, the four Geneva Conventions of 1949, and there's two additional protocols of 1977. And that's sort of the core. But then you have a lot of weapons treaties on how you can use weapons during armed conflict. So this would be chemical weapons, biological weapons, landmines, all these things we would also consider to be part of IHL, even though they're individual treaties. And then you have customary international law, which is sort of the state practice and the way states feel. So they might do something because they feel legally obligated to. So that's what we call opinio iuris. So it's the state practice and opinio iuris of states that makes customary law. And so for a lot of things, we sort of refer to those bodies based on what states believe is legally obligatory, even if it's not written down in a treaty.
So what is the legal definition of armed conflict?
So it's a protracted violence between organized armed groups. When we're talking about states, you're really just if two states. We call it the one-shot theory. If there's sort of a use of force, one shot's enough between two states, then you have what's called an international armed conflict. If you have non-state actors, so armed groups like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, or whoever, the Taliban, then you're looking more at how organized these armed groups are and how intense the violence is. And these factors and criteria are found in different jurisprudence, primarily in the jurisprudence of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the ICTY. So that's kind of where we get some of these legal definitions outside of the Geneva Conventions themselves. But
we have another question or comment from one of our listeners.
Yes, Andrea, what are the linkages, if any, between the ICRC and the International War Crimes Tribune in The Hague? Can the ICRC testify against individuals accused of crimes against humanity?
So you say, what are the links
between?
Okay. So, yes, no, no, we can't testify. That's the easy answer. So we have, long been engaged in those tribunals in the sense that we were on the ground in a lot of the conflicts. And we are very supportive of international criminal law. But the way the ICRC operates through a confidential dialogue, we consider to be a customary international law principle. And it has been recognized in the ICTY, in the International Criminal Court. For example, there's actually a statute or provision of the Rome Statute, Rule 73, which specifically exempts the ICRC from testifying. And so as far as international criminal law goes anyways, it's very clear that the ICRC is never obligated to provide evidence or to testify in a trial. And that's in order to preserve our access in conflicts. If parties to a conflict knew that as soon as we get into a prison and note the conditions and we head over to the court to hand in information, they're just not going to let us into the prison. And there are organizations who are out there to be more advocates and to have a public voice, and we find their work to be complementary to ours, but our specific mission really is something that operates within that sort of confidential framework. I don't know if that's fully answering, but...
Well, I'd love for us to delve more into the negotiation elements of the work that you do and ICRC does, as this show is part of the negotiation course that we're offering this month. And at the beginning of the course, the instructor, Anthony Wani St. John, who you know and teach with at AU, it introduces course by saying that negotiation is a skill and that it can be taught and if integrated effectively can actually be quite personally empowering. And so were you trained to practice a specific kind of negotiation and all the work that you're doing as a liaison between governments abroad and here in the United States in your current capacity, were you trained to negotiate in those circumstances? So in other words, is there an ICRC way to negotiate humanitarian law issues? And do they train folks to do that type of negotiation?
It's a very interesting question. So the short answer for me is no. I had a lot of amazing mentors over the last few years who kind of learned from watching. And I think an institution as old and as well established as the ICRC, it works more or less that way, that you sort of learn from your boss and they learn from their boss on how to negotiate a checkpoint or whatever it may be. But it's not very formal. The one sort of training that we have that's quite formal is for what we call our mobile delegates or mobile staff. And it's a very small percentage actually of ICRC employees, and they go through what's called an integration course. And it's 3 weeks out in sort of like the forest of Geneva, if you can call it that. It's supposed to be the jungle. And they really have to go through some exercises there on, you know, they get kidnapped and, you know, fake kidnapped, I guess, at gunpoint, and are like taught to negotiate their way out of a hostage situation, or again, through a checkpoint to bring maybe an ambulance through a checkpoint. So I think if you go through that program, you have a little, but that's really probably like 1 day, 2 days. It's not the core focus. And again, the people who are teaching you are often the people who've just done it themselves before. But I think the ICRC is starting to recognize that it has a need for maybe a more formal approach to this. And then they're looking at different avenues to do this. But yeah, at the moment, it's very much sort of a learn as you go, and you know, watching people who do it better than you do it. And
well, going back to the kind of legal elements of international humanitarian law and your role, so for, you know, for the layperson who may have heard of but not read the Geneva Conventions that are at the core, as you mentioned, of international humanitarian law, how do you negotiate with governments about such treaties, and what do you find complicated about that?
So, I mean, I guess what's easy about it is that every state in the world is party to the Geneva Conventions, and we consider all, like, everyone to be bound, including non-state actors. So that at least makes it easy in the sense that, okay, everyone's bound by it, so it should always apply. On the other hand, we work in states where we go in and we're not allowed to say the word armed conflict, we're not allowed to say the word IHL. And so that even if we internally believe there might be an armed conflict and that the Geneva Conventions apply, the ICRC is not an enforcement body, so we can't force a state to accept our reading of a situation or of what the law should be. And in those cases, you often have to sort of take a step back and say, okay, we believe the law is this, but this is not working. So what is our end objective? It's not to get these guys to accept our reading of the law. It's to have better results for the civilian population, to sort of improve the humanitarian situation on the ground. So sometimes that might mean changing the dialogue a little bit and relying more on sort of basic humanitarian principles or whatever it is we can use to sort of get the results we want, regardless of whether we're happy with how the state receives our sort of interpretation of their obligations under international law.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. We are joined in the studio today by our guest, Andrea Harrison. She is Deputy Legal Advisor to the Washington Delegation of the International Committee of the Red Cross. And we're talking about international humanitarian law and issues of negotiation that pop up when dealing with various actors in armed conflict. We welcome your questions and comments, all of you listening online, to chime in and help us guide this conversation. And it looks like we have a question or comment from one of our listeners.
Yes, it's a good question. I understand that ICRC is negotiating humanitarian access in respect of IHL. However, is ICRC mediating between conflicting parties to prevent or reduce levels of violence or improve civilians' access to basic rights? In other words, is ICRC using mediation to promote protection of civilians?
So yes, definitely mediating between parties. I guess that depends on how you're thinking about that. We don't necessarily act as like a messenger service between party A and party B, but we would bring the same sort of humanitarian message to both party A and party B. And now due to the confidentiality sort of restraints, we wouldn't be able to say, okay, well, party A is violating this, so party B, you're doing a much better job. You should know that. We're not going to be able to share those sorts of interesting bits of information. But we are going to go to party A, let's say, and say, look, we've already told party B this is a law. Now we're telling you this is the law, and you should both be respecting your obligations. And so, again, trying to make sure all the parties realize we're talking to everyone. We're not just focusing on them. And you know, I think sometimes states get a little annoyed because, like, well, why don't you tell the non-state actor who's ambushing us that, you know, that they should obey the law as well? Well, of course, we're also trying to do that, but that doesn't mean that you, the state, have a right to violate the law. So in that sense, there's some mediation, but I mean, usually because of the sort of bilateral nature, it's more between us and the governments, or us and the non-state actor, as it may be. There's a few exceptions I can think of where it would be a little bit more like what you would think of as a mediation. And that would be, for example, what we do in Colombia sometimes with a hostage. We don't actually do the negotiation, but we'll be the intermediary between getting sort of a hostage that's been taken by one party back to, so it's, I don't want to accuse one party, but say an armed group in the jungle, and we'll negotiate. We'll sort of bring the message to the government of Colombia, and we will there act as an intermediary perhaps, and then actually facilitate perhaps the physical transfer of the person back to their home. So there we would be sort of an intermediary, but that's not the, that's not our, usually our first and foremost, I would say, endeavor. But in Colombia, we've been there a long time. It's just something that we've found we can bring added value. Another place we have been working on with Colombia has also been to some extent in the peace negotiations between the FARC and it's not as so much an intermediary, it's just having sort of like a good offices, having someone there who's independent to sort of like share a voice throughout the negotiations.
We have another question from one of our listeners.
Yes. To which degree does ICRC engage in negotiating humanitarian corridors to deliver aid? Can you give any specific examples of cases? And also, does the ICRC negotiate ceasefires?
So on humanitarian corridors, this is a very interesting question because it depends on what you're talking about by humanitarian corridors. I will say most of the time when people refer to that term, they're talking, or at least in their head, they're thinking about sort of a enforced corridor where sort of one party to the conflict or even a neutral third state comes in and sort of creates a safe space where maybe civilians can come to or whatever. From the ICRC's perspective, that's not actually humanitarian. If you're going to have to enforce anything with violence, with weapons, or by basically invading the sovereignty of another state, then that's sort of already taking it out of this sort of purely humanitarian realm. And so for us, we might negotiate for ourselves or any of our sort of partners to get into an area. And if that's what we're talking about, where we're just like saying, okay, if the parties to the conflict will let us go through this road today during these hours, we're going to bring this medical supply, that we would definitely take a part in negotiating. If it's state A imposing on state B this like safety area, then that we would have a problem working with because of the neutrality issue there of sort of one state forcing itself on another or whatever it may be. And in practice, I don't know if there's ever been a successful humanitarian corridor of that nature anyways, where a state's come in and sort of by force provided a safe area. I mean, the Geneva Conventions do talk about sort of safe zones and areas where there shouldn't be hostilities, but that's based on sort of a mutual agreement by the parties to the conflict, the states in that case, agreeing not to engage in hostilities in a certain area. And normally when we're talking about humanitarian corridors, we're talking about something sort of different where it's really is being imposed on one side or the other. Ceasefires, not per se. Again, if we might ask two sides to sort of stop fighting while we bring humanitarian assistance, and that's one thing. But as far as like a political peaceful settlement to a conflict, and that's not really our expertise, where we're really more concerned about the conduct in an armed conflict or while violence is going on. Of course, we're all for peace, so it's not that we're opposed to it. It's just not sort of our role it's not how we see our roles as sort of doing the political negotiations of a ceasefire.
Can you take us into a room or a meeting where you are negotiating around the law that needs to be followed or the law that's being interpreted that needs to be followed in an armed conflict? So earlier you mentioned, let's say, a drone strike that has killed civilians, and those who are operating on the ground in the theater of battle versus those back in the Pentagon or what have you, understanding what are the legal ramifications in order to respond to this. What do you do in that situation? Like, paint us the picture. Are there times when your interpretation, and you're trying to educate those who are involved in the conflict, you're trying to educate them about the legal ramifications of what is happening? Are there moments where there's just fundamental disagreement on the interpretation of the law, which then has an impact on what they then do, should be doing, or should stop doing as a result of that law? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. No, I think so. So maybe I'll take it back to detention. So I don't think I had a chance to answer your earlier question about what I do on detention anyway. So for example, if we had an issue come up in, I'm going to go to Afghanistan, not Guantanamo, because I feel like Guantanamo is always a hornet's nest. So for when the U.S. was operating its detention facility in Bagram in Parwan there in Afghanistan, and let's say an issue arose as to how frequently the detainees were getting phone calls home. then maybe there would be a conversation there at sort of command level there in Kabul or near Kabul. But then probably at some point it would come to my desk and they'd be like, okay, the ICRC don't think that these detainees are getting sufficient family contacts. It's causing psychological difficulties for them. They're very restless. So there we would sort of evaluate, okay, first of all, what's the international law on that? Like what does the Geneva Conventions say about family contacts for detainees in this particular situation where it's a state holding non-state actors? Does it say anything at all? Hopefully it does. Maybe we might have to refer to another body of law like human rights law or Afghan domestic law or even sort of U.S. Maybe not domestic law, but maybe like U.S. military practice. Like what does their manual say about how often they have to facilitate family contacts in this situation? And we would kind of make an analysis internally. And then we would also, again, sort of decide what is our goal as far as the humanitarian consequences go? Are we asking for them to double it or triple it? Or we are not really asking for a number, but we just want them to improve it. Like what are we looking at here? And so we would sort of bring this package. So it's sort of the legal package plus the protection package to whoever. I mean, in a case of detention, we would probably be going to the Office of Detainee Policy at the Pentagon and just sitting down and being like, okay, this is our reading of the law, including maybe of the U.S. law or your directives or your standard operating procedures. Maybe we agree with all of the law, or maybe we think that the law is not in keeping with international standards. There might be a debate there. And so part of the conversation will be there, but often we're not going to agree on the law, just to be honest. So that's the U.S. has a very particular way of approaching international legal frameworks. And so sometimes you get a little stuck on black letter law, and it's a little easier to just move off and be like, okay, but we can agree that it's a good humanitarian principle for detainees to be able to contact their families. And so then we can kind of step back from the law and then talk about sort of that and then sort of negotiate, okay, so what's feasible? What can you actually do on the ground there to improve the family context? Is it going to be doubling it? Is it going to be whatever it may be? I'm actually using not a real example since I probably couldn't talk about a real example, but you sort of get the idea that it's, you do have the legal discussion, but it's a tool so that you sort of know where your position is, but then you can sort of move in order to compromise. You're going to be kind of looking at things beyond the law often.
Okay. So given that fictional situation, situations like it, we've been talking a lot this week in the course about the importance of preparing for negotiation. And Anthony talked a lot about how that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make is they enter into negotiation without even thinking what their desired end goal or outcome is. And all of a sudden they're just in the middle of it and they haven't prepared. So given the range of negotiations of which you've been a part, negotiations like the ones you just described, what is the Andrea Harrison way of approaching or preparing for these kinds of negotiations?
So I think, again, having already confessed the fact I have no formal training on this, I think what I've found from trial and error has been I really have found that it works so much better when you have a personal connection to one person in the room. And by personal connection, I mean that very, very loosely in the sense that I've met this person before. And that's really, it makes a huge difference. And when I know I'm going to go into a room with a bunch of people I haven't had to work with before or talk with before, I will often ask my colleagues if any of them know someone who's going to be on the other side, if I can even bring them, even if they have nothing to do with that file, just to have someone in the room who knows someone on the other side, it makes a huge difference. It's, as you can really tell, the atmosphere of the room will often change when one of my colleagues walks in and recognizes someone and they make that, you know, quick, oh, hey, it's nice to see you. But everyone in the room sees that and everyone sees that, okay, these aren't strangers. These aren't scary people. Like they're human beings. And I think that always makes a difference. And so if there are situations where I know we don't know these people, nobody knows these people, but I still have to have this meeting. Often I'll try to find a way to have a phone call or a coffee with sort of like whatever the working level person first, informally before the sort of official formal meeting, just to have already sort of kind of sussed each other out, had a conversation. And again, it makes it so much easier when you go into that sort of formal setting where everyone has their party lines and has to be sort of, you know, behaving in front of their bosses. Because I think then they tend to try to help you out a little bit. You have a little more nonverbal cues because you've met that person before and you're more familiar with them.
Now, when you approach a government or an armed group as a member of the ICRC, I'm wondering, are the dynamics that you enter into such that they're thinking, oh no, we're being approached by the legal department of ICRC, we're doing something wrong, or we're doing something illegal, and we're here to be convinced of that or told of that, now we have to change. Is that kind of the attitude that you enter into being a legal representative of the ICRC?
I think it's going to depend on what I know we're going in to say. On the one hand, we have sort of this general principle of this confidentiality. And so states or non-state actors know as we go in, okay, well, whatever we talk about, it's not going to get sent out to the press. We're not going to be hearing about it the next day everywhere. They're not going to be writing long advocacy reports, which, again, as I said before, organizations that do that play a very important role. I don't mean to denigrate their work. But as far as the ICRC goes, like, they know, okay, we're going to be able to have this in confidence, and we can sort of duke it out and have a candid discussion. And we might not agree, and often we won't. But I think they're a little more open for the reason that they know they're not going to get, like, smacked on the head with it the next day. So that helps. On the other hand, there's a few issues that, you know, traditionally we've worked on that I know the U.S. government hears that we're working on, like, you know, I don't know, nuclear weapons or something. And they just like, oh, no, because, like, you know, it's going to be very hard to find common ground there. And I don't mean to, that's just like one random one, but it could be other things where, you know, it's going to be a lot more difficult going in, and you just have to, I don't know, I just find going in with like a positive attitude and just immediately expressing up front, knowing, okay, we know this is difficult. This is not going to be an easy thing. We know we're not going to be able to agree on everything here, but let's at least see if there's one thing we can identify, we can work on together, even if it's really tiny. And sometimes approaching it with that sort of like, let's have a little success. Even if it's overall not going to be maybe a huge success, then I think that they sort of appreciate having that understanding that it's not going to be an easy negotiation, I think.
Let's turn now to one of our listeners.
Negotiations suggests two or more opposing views or sides and efforts to resolve those disagreements and end the conflict or disharmony. The best case scenario is the so-called win-win outcome of the mediation or negotiation. A less desired outcome is the winners-losers situation. Given the deep-seated emotions and histories which lead to armed conflict over the past half century, has the ICRC been party to more win-win negotiations and outcomes, or has the practical realities been more dictated by the situation on the ground of one party being the winner and the other the loser?
That's an interesting way of thinking about how armed conflict works. I think for armed conflict, that's probably more the lose-lose scenario, because armed conflict is a brutal situation no matter where. I mean, when something raises the level of an armed conflict, you've already decided that the violence is so intense that you've had to pretty much displace entire legal regimes, domestic law or certain aspects of human rights law in order to apply international humanitarian law in the first place. And if for those of you who might be familiar with international humanitarian law, like, one way to think about it is it allows you to use lethal force as a matter of first resort, where international human rights law, it's basically use of lethal force has to be a last resort. And so just flipping that on its head, there's nothing really good that comes out of armed conflict. So it's hard to say. I mean, the best situation is when you have two sides of an armed conflict, or however many sides, all at least agreeing to apply the rules they've signed up to the best of their ability. That would be a win-win, I suppose. But that still means a lot of people are going to be dying. A lot of damage is going to be done. And so I think it's a little hard to quantify it or qualify it in that way. I mean, as far as like the political outcomes, yeah, it's probably is usually win-lose. Or today, I mean, what we've seen the last couple of decades, it's actually not win or lose. It's like ongoing simmering conflict for decades. So there is no final outcome, and you're just continually dealing with these humanitarian consequences. Sorry to be so depressing on a Tuesday afternoon.
Now, some of the skills and concepts that we've covered this week in the course touch on, one, being able to demonstrate empathy for your counterpart, another skill is being able to identify the interests that lie beneath the positions or demands that are being made in a negotiation. Another skill has been being persuasive without being threatening. Another one has been to have a strong walkaway or BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And then five, developing a core message in order to be proactive in a negotiation. So I'd like to touch on a few of these specific skills or concepts and hear how you employ some of these to optimize your negotiations. And I think you've touched on some already in terms of having somebody in the room who knows or has some type of personal relationship with someone, you know, who's your counterpart. So I'd like to start with emotional intelligence and empathy. What do you understand emotional intelligence to be? And do you consider yourself to be an emotionally intelligent negotiator?
I'd probably be fired if I answered that any other way. Right, exactly.
Yes, right. That's a softball for you.
I mean, having not ever really sort of discussed this in an academic setting, I guess emotional intelligence for me would just be the sort of attitudes and prejudices of the person on the other side or whoever it is I'm dealing with. And I think I at least have improved a lot on being able to sort of recognize those in a room and also to identify sort of underlying things that are going on that you can tell someone might be stressed or upset or have a bad relationship with one of their counterparts. And I think that it's become easier and easier to pick up on as I do this more. I would say that where I probably fail the most is if I really get an interlocutor, a contact, whoever I'm working with on the other side who's very hostile or who just really, or who maybe does not have any emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Then I find I'm not really great at overcoming that, at working with that kind of a person. Like I need the other person on the other side to sort of have a little bit of flexibility and openness.
Now, someone asked the question earlier about approaching and negotiating with non-state actors like ISIS, ISIL, or Boko Haram. And, you know, these are non-state actors that are continuing to commit horrific acts of violence against civilian populations. When we talk about empathy and going into negotiation with that skill set, have you found yourself in a situation where your counterpart, and you are aware of this, has committed horrific acts of violence or is responsible for horrific acts of violence, and you're now at a table with this person? I imagine it must be difficult to develop and demonstrate empathy for that person, but I could be wrong. Have you found yourself in that situation where your counterpart, you know, has just committed horrible acts of violence and it makes the negotiation very uncomfortable or difficult?
So I haven't been able to sit across the room from someone who, I mean, would be identifiable as maybe having just committed a crime or whatever, though I have had to sit across the room from people whose policies I know resulted in very serious violations of IHL, or at least as I would interpret it. And I think there's a difference between what people do and who they are as human beings. And I think it's actually not so difficult in practice when you develop sort of a personal relationship with someone to have a conversation. I mean, everyone is a human being and some humans commit horrible atrocities, but you can usually find something human about anyone that you're working with. These detainees in Guantanamo, many of whom are accused of committing really horrible crimes against Americans. I mean, they have mothers and children and write to their wives on a regular basis. And, you know, there's no justifying what acts they might have committed, but that doesn't mean you can't have a conversation with those persons or the persons who put them there and who may have committed atrocities against them. At some point, that there's still, I think, there's something you just have to sort of separate. I don't think, as a lawyer, I think maybe we're trained more to set our emotions aside, and you always look at both sides of any story. So you never go in being really I'm for this or really I'm for that. You really have got to try to be in each person's shoes and think about what it's like for them. That doesn't mean you have to agree with anything they do, but I think it's a good skill to always walk in and be like, okay, why has this person done this? And to be honest, I haven't had too much of an issue of working with people who I maybe vehemently disagree with personally.
Another concept that we've been exploring this week in the course is the distinction between the positions that someone takes in a negotiation versus the underlying interests. Can you help us clarify what's the difference between positions or demands and interests in a negotiation?
Sure. I mean, from my perspective, kind of always working sort of with U.S. government, so that I think the way I think about it is, if you're working with, let's say, the military, you have the U.S. government position. So it's the face of things. It's their policy statements. But then the agency or the department within the agency or the tiny office within the department are going to have different interests. Now, they all have to sort of line up behind that party line and agree to the position, again, at least in public. But it's pretty quickly clear what interests that these groups are going to have. And it'll be based on a number of different things, that their objective and what they're doing on the ground, let's say in Afghanistan, or it could be personal interests on whether they want to be promoted to a different area. I mean, it can be any number of things that will motivate someone, but they're usually going to have to hold the party line, but it's, you start to learn, okay, but I know that this person actually wants something else other than the party line, and how could we achieve this without them having to sort of blatantly go against what the position they've been told they have to take.
Are there any strategies that you have, excuse me, that you can share that help your counterpart reveal or be more open about their interests, especially when you see the negotiation getting stuck in unrealistic demands?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always going to depend on the relationship that I have with the person I'm having to negotiate. If it's a good relationship, if we've worked together for at least some time, hopefully by then we've built up enough trust that I can just be pretty clear about, okay, off the record, what's going on here? What is it you guys want? Where are your gives? And maybe they can't reveal everything, but you will often, from, again, nonverbal cues, sort of get an indication, okay, what's the most important, what's not so important. And you can also give a little as well. When you don't have that relationship, it's a little bit trickier to, I think, get people to sort of show their cards. Often what I found is if I give a little bit of useful information proactively, even if they haven't asked for it, if I can offer something or to help them, often they're overloaded with work and I can be like, well, you know, I could do this thing for you or make these phone calls for you and get this information for you if you would like work on finding out this for me. And that I found people are often much more willing to agree to something when you've sort of proactively offered them some sort of support of some kind.
We've also talked about ways to identify and gain leverage in a negotiation. And I'm wondering, have you ever entered into negotiation and you realize there's great power asymmetry, you have less power in the situation, and then through the course of the negotiation, you've been able to employ certain strategies to build and gain leverage in that situation? So we've talked specifically in the course about having a strong walkaway, having a credible constraint, identifying weaknesses in your counterpart's walk away. These are just a few, but are there some examples you could share where you really feel like, wow, I really gained leverage in this negotiation? And what did you do?
Again, it's hard with the confidential thing to try to talk in hypotheticals without giving too specific of details. But probably the most recent example would be during the closure of Bagram, the U.S. detention facility. There were a couple months there where we were really trying to ensure that certain detainees were transferred in a humane manner to certain locations, if possible. I mean, the U.S. had to transfer them no matter what, but we had certain goals for family reunification, for whatever it may be, to get detainees in certain areas. And of course, the U.S. had very different objectives. I mean, they wanted to also treat these people in a humane way, but had security concerns and things that were not really our main focus. And so there was definitely a pull throughout it. And I could tell very quickly that the two sides were really starting to separate and have a lot of tensions between some of my colleagues in the field in Afghanistan and the U.S. government representatives in Afghanistan, and then also in Washington and Geneva, and there was really a lot of tension. And so I just started making basically daily phone calls, emails, incident, whatever I could do, and talking to every single person that I could every day, and keeping that sort of communication chain constant. And I found that that really helped very quickly to sort of allay some of these tensions, because a lot of it was from miscommunication or one person saying one thing when they maybe didn't have actually all the information and should have waited. And so they were just getting frustrated because they would get half a story and not the whole thing. And so I just started, it was probably like 7 days a week for 2 months there that I was just always on the phone. And in the end, I think not everything went as we wanted it, but also we, I think, got a lot of good results. And I think a lot of it came from just sort of forcing everyone to continue to talk and not to just like walk away and be like, well, you're not giving us this. We're fed up. We're done. And I think that was something, also a learning experience for me, but I think it was very successful to see how sort of keeping everyone, I don't want to say happy, but just sort of everyone sort of like satiated with information anyways, really contributed to sort of an overall successful closure of that facility.
Now, over your years of experience in international humanitarian law and working with ICRC, I assume obviously you've been part of negotiations and conversations that you feel have been very successful and really had a positive outcome. I assume you've also been part of negotiations and meetings that you felt were just, you know, kind of failed and just didn't work out really well. So in all your years of experience and what you've learned from these successes and from these not so successful negotiations, I don't want to call them failures, but not so successful negotiations, how do you feel, like, what have you learned as, again, a lawyer, but also a lawyer that does negotiation around these issues? And how do you feel you become a better negotiator as a result of these experiences? How do you feel you've developed as a negotiator?
Definitely confidence helps in negotiations. And certainly when I first started working without having much training and getting kind of thrown into meetings and things where I just really didn't know what I was doing. And you learn very quickly from your mistakes, how not to come unprepared, how to try to make sure you know who's going to be on the other side. So a lot of what I learned was definitely trial and error, which is maybe not the best way to go about it, but it's not necessarily a bad way if you can actually learn from your mistakes and sort of take those experiences and try to improve for future negotiations. And I think honestly, the sort of uncomfortable, awkward, not successful negotiations are sometimes more helpful, especially earlier in your career, than having a lot of wins, because you're not going to learn so much from the wins or from the easy ones. It's kind of good to sort of get thrown to the wolves a little bit. It's not fun, but it's good. So I think that would be sort of my advice to people. Don't be scared to take some risks.
Well, that's great. And that brings us to the end of our show. And Andrea, thank you for being with us in the studio today.
Very welcome. It was great.
You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our guest today has been Andrea Harrison, Deputy Legal Advisor for the Washington Delegation of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Our producers are Leah Cullens, Vanessa Francis, Kara Stevens, and Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Blake Mobley. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon, and I have been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to all of our listeners from around the world for your questions and comments. Tune in next Tuesday at 2:30 p.m. Our guest will be Steve Donaldson with the U.S. Army. Until then, keep learning, supporting, and building peace. Thank you.